Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio, shortwave radio, and, well, radio period. Today, it's the rebroadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2013. So, keep that radio dial tuned right where it's at. And here it comes on QSO. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's hamtestonline.com.
We're live. This is Dayton, Ohio. This is the Hamvention 2013 is where we're at. And we're really glad you folks have tuned in and joined us. We're really happy to have you tuned in on the shortwave radio. If you're listening on a stream somewhere, there's all kinds of streams going on. We have upstream going. We have the stream on the WTWW website on transmitter number 2 going. And then we also have the QSO stream going. So there's 3 of those. Where we want to say hello to Alan Wiener and all the folks at WBCQ. We want to thank them, along with Rod Hembry, with the Good Friends Radio Network, for allowing us to occupy 9330 today. Wonderful radio station, wonderful signal, and Alan Wiener is an incredible radio guy. And if you folks don't know much about Alan, go to our website and under the podcast and check out his story, because well, I'll tell you what, talk about a pioneer in shortwave radio. This guy is, he wrote the book on it, and if he hasn't, I guess he did. Maybe there is a book that he's written. It seems like there is. But his story, that we do the interview with him on podcast, is just absolutely incredible. And there's some videos of Alan up on YouTube. His history and background in shortwave radio is just absolutely most incredible. We've got a couple of folks that have sat down to join us here, and if I can figure out which is the live microphones, can you get up on the mic, right up on top of it, because it's close talking. We've got a lot of background noise in here, and you do the same thing. This gentleman here was just brought by for Ham Test Online came by. Now, is this going to be? There we go. Okay. And why don't you introduce yourself and tell me your name and what's going on?
My name is Calvin, K0DXC. I'm just here enjoying the Hamvention.
Okay, he needs a little more game.
Try it again. Yeah, I know that most folks heard you, but there's a lot of echo behind you there.
Yeah, no, my name is Calvin, K0DXC, and I'm just here enjoying the Hamvention along with everybody else.
There you go. And I noticed that John Cunningham brought you by here. Now, there must have been a reason why he brought you by.
Yeah, no, I've known John for a few years now. Actually, I came here the last time I was at the Hamvention was, I think, 3 years ago. And I was a general class at the time, and I really needed to get my extra to go to Jamaica and operate so I could get the reciprocity. And I remember I was pretty skeptical. I didn't know if an online course would work, but it took me a week and a half, and I had my extra.
A week and a half?
A week and a half.
Unbelievable.
So, and 93% on the test, too. It wasn't a squeak by. It was fantastic. The software actually did work.
Well, I'll tell you something. We hear this. This is just a constant thing about Ham Test Online. I mean, we talk to folks, they rave about it. They go, wow, that was really, really cool. So tell me a little bit. I mean, have you ever done any kind of like an online course or any kind of studying for a particular test before in any areas other than ham radio?
No, that was my first experience at the time. I'm in high school right now. I'm a senior in high school, but okay. I do college with my high school post-secondary education option. And I take college classes online in addition to my high school curriculum, but I've never done any kind of course study online for a test or anything before Ham Test Online.
I didn't know, because a lot of folks say, I've done a lot of online studying, and this is like the easiest thing that I've ever come across in terms of... But I guess one of the things, too, is a lot of online courses can bore you. You can fall asleep while you're doing it. But that thing moves along. It moves along at a pace, and it's always challenging you, and it'll repeat the questions that you either miss or don't understand, and it'll do it enough to where you finally get it. I mean, and enough explanation from the technical side of it to where you have a good reason as to why you're picking the answer you're picking. You may not understand the entire technical scheme of things, but at least you have a glimpse as to why you're picking that answer.
Yeah, no, I really like how the questions and the material, they were all really tied to each specific section. You know, like it wasn't like you were just memorizing questions, but it would give you the section of the book, and then it would ask you the questions that relate directly to that section. So it's the information is fresh in your mind, and it really helps you to put two and two together, connect them. It was really good, you know, and I, like, my biggest motivation was a little progress meter at the bottom of the screen, like, oh, you're 8% through the material, or you're 20%, you know, when you get to 60%, you start passing the exams, and then it's nice, you know, it eggs you on, a little friendly competition with yourself.
Now, let me ask you this question. What is your interest right now in amateur radio? You got an extra class. Where do you spend most of your time?
I do a lot of contesting from different stations, usually up on the East Coast. I used to have a station at my house. I lived in Ohio, but I moved a couple years ago to Minnesota, and there's not really room for an antenna anymore. But I like contesting. I like going to hamventions. I like doing stuff like that.
Very, very good. Well, I really appreciate you coming by here and talking and sharing with us. And I your story is I guess I want to say one of many of folks that have done Ham Test Online, and they come back going, "Wow, I passed. It was cool, you know." And I'll tell you something. I've looked at everything out there, and I haven't seen anything yet that really compares with it. You know, there's just. It's not that difficult when you use that, but it can be very difficult depending on what books you've got and what CDs you're listening to and all that kind of stuff. So.
That's true.
Well, thank you so much. And your call sign is?
K0 Delta X-Ray Charlie.
K0 Delta X-Ray Charlie. And where do you get on HF at all? Where folks around the country,
yep.
where can they look for you?
I'd say 20 or 40 meters.
20 or 40. Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming by and talking
with us. Thanks for having me.
All righty. This just seems to be the consistent thing here. Ham Test Online. People sign up and they get their tickets and they go away happy. I've got a gentleman here with me, and I'm going to have you introduce yourself, and I'm going to make sure that your mic is live here. Is his mic live? Is his microphone live?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Get right up on it.
Are we live? Are we actually live?
You're going to need to get up a little closer.
Okay, I'm Dave Burgess, WA2TVS from the Battleship, New Jersey, amateur radio station.
and tell me a little bit about, I know we talked to Pi extensively about the Museum Ships Weekend.
Yes.
And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Pi and his group on board the USS Salem up in Boston started the event back about 1999. They managed to get 10 museum ships from around the country on the ham bands for the same weekend. Just to have QSOs and everybody have a chance to contact the museum ship, find out what the ship was all about. About 2003, 2004, it got so large that they asked the Battleship New Jersey if we could help them with the management of it. And in 2 weeks, when the event happens for 2013, we'll have at least 93 museum ships on the air from around the world for the 48-hour period. And I have to emphasize, it's not a contest. It's a loosely coordinated grouping of 93 museum ships, special event stations.
Okay, now, but I guess I'm going to say, don't people tend to treat it like a contest? I mean, don't you have pileups and all those kind of things going on, people trying to make contact with the ships? Now, what if you work all the ships, there's a certificate or something, isn't it?
To work all 93 ships, I'll bow forever to the ham that can do that when you consider the propagation gods. But if you work 15 different ships, this isn't five ships on three bands or anything like that. If you work 15 different ships, you send the an extract of your log, the call sign, the date, the frequency, and we'll check the logs of those ships to make sure you made the contact, and we will send you a really nice color photo paper type certificate of your achievement.
Well, I was going to say, why don't you tell us a little bit about the background on some of these ships? Because some of these ships have an incredibly interesting history.
Oh, well, every one of them does. I have an abbreviated list here. Let me just go through the types of ships. And I do not have my reading glasses with me. They're brand new. Aircraft carriers, tugboats, battleships, bulk carriers from the Great Lakes, the iron ore carriers that built the country through what's now the Rust Belt, Coast Guard cutters, cruisers like the Indianapolis that I hope more people know about, delivered the atomic bomb at the end of the war that was dropped on near Nagasaki, but was then torpedoed, and two-thirds of her crew died to shark attacks. Destroyers, freighters, frigates, hospital ships, icebreakers, liberty ships, light ships, minesweepers, even some stern-wheel paddle ships up in the Mississippi. Submarines galore. The best one is the Batfish. In Oklahoma, they have a submarine sitting in a park far from water. It's a whole nother story how they got there. All the way down to a new one, the Coast Guard cutter McLean is going to be on the air. Again, a museum ship. They all have a history. There's a reason people wanted them near their home for tourism and everything. But from the Indianapolis with the shark attack, and the Navy didn't even know she had been sunk for 3 days, to my favorite would be the Battleship New Jersey and her long history. She's just now ready to go 70 years old. Great history.
Well, you know, I guess I was going to ask this question, and that is... let's just take, for example, the iron ore carriers. You know, originally I'm from Michigan, so I remember watching those things up and down the Great Lakes. And, of course, as you see them at a distance, you don't really realize how huge these things are.
Oh, they're mammoth.
And then, even if you're up close and you start looking at them, you see how huge they are. You don't really realize how much weight these things are carrying, you know. They got all that, like, taconite inside these things. I remember, like, when the Edmund Fitzgerald went down.
I was just going to bring her up.
You know, there was this whole thing about the weight that boat was carrying, and it's like, it's mind-boggling. You know, they're carrying that much on a boat, you know, and they do it on a regular basis.
Yes, the Great Lake iron ore carriers... as I said earlier, made this country. Without the iron ore, Carnegie Steel, Republic Steel, United Steel could not have done what they did over the years. Now the ships are being replaced by other methods, but I grew up in Cleveland, so we were basically on the Great Lakes together somewhere in our past, and I used to sit there in Cleveland, Lorain area, and look at these ore carriers coming in. As a child, I had no idea how big they were until I got on board the one that's currently in Cleveland, on display, and you get to go into the holds, and it's like you can play an entire basketball game six times in there at the simultaneously. They're just huge, and it's great to go in and see what this stuff is all about.
Well, I guess, you know, the boats have always fascinated me because I grew up in the Detroit area.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Detroit area, we had what was known as the Boblo boats. And they were like a little excursion vehicles. They parked at the foot of Woodward Avenue, and they would take you either on a cruise, or you could get on the boat and go over to Boblo Island, which was an amusement park, you know. There was another big boat that parked in the Detroit area that was used extensively for a while, and then, of course, I don't know what happened to it, and it was called the Aquarama. They had quite a time with that one because the wind would catch it in the Detroit River, and they couldn't control it.
It was big.
But I never remember seeing an iron ore carrier going through the Detroit River. I don't think I've ever seen that.
Oh, well, they had to be because they're coming up from Lake Superior. That would be the story of Edmund Fitzgerald, the winds of November.
Yeah, I don't ever recall seeing one on the Detroit River. I mean, and being downtown, but as you went up north and you got up toward Tawas, you get up toward Agre, and all through the eastern coast of Michigan, where the lake runs alongside, and there's all those little towns and villages that are kind of tourist oriented, and you're up close to the lake, you get to look out. On the and I don't know if that would have been, what was that now? Would that be like Huron? Would that be? I guess maybe it would be Huron, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're looking out across there, and you could see those iron ore carriers. You
mm-hmm.
know? Then, as you got up toward the Straits, and you go to Mackinac,
mm-hmm.
and where, now the Straits were what? Straits weren't, they were, is it the Sioux, or I can't remember where the Straits are at.
Sioux St. Marie.
Were they the locks?
Yes.
Okay. And you'd get by the locks, and those guys would go through there, and you'd look at those boats, and you would think, oh my God, how do they float?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
They're somewhere like 600 feet long, 90, not quite 100 feet. Somebody passing by just said almost 1,000 feet.
Okay. Well, now, let me ask you this question. Are there ore carriers set up doing museum ships weekends?
Yes. I was just looking here. We have what was the Bradley when she was carrying iron ore. She's since been converted back to her original name of the Schumacher. That's in Toledo. And my brain has gone total gray right now for the name of the one that's in Cleveland. I've been on board that ship. It's a fantastic place to visit. It's right next to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, so it's a nice little short stroll there. I wish I could think the name of it. There's a couple of others. What are they here? I'm going to go dead time. The Bradley is there. That would be the Schumacher. I think there's three. Pardon? Oh, the Keewatin wasn't an ore carrier. She was a ferry. Passenger ferry did excursions across the lake, is privately owned now, and they were on the air the last three years for Museum Ships Weekend. She's now in Canada, and I believe there's a group going to bring her up for Museum Ships this weekend, in 2 weeks, not this weekend.
Now, of course, as you go to the West Coast, there is the infamous Queen Mary.
Queen Mary is a fantastic ship. Ham Radio was involved in here for decades now.
And I've talked to several radio amateurs that tell me that Queen Mary is haunted.
Ooh.
And there are things that go on in the Queen Mary. So
No idea.
You don't have any idea?
No,
huh?
Never been to California.
Well, I this is what I've been told. I've been told that there's certain parts of the ship that you go down to the lower parts of the ship, and you can hear things. You can hear voices and all kinds of stuff, and you carry a little pocket recorder with you. So I don't know what the history is, but I've been told that. Matter of fact, I think one of the ghost shows on television, I don't know which one it was, went in and...
I remember that, but I don't remember what ship they were on.
No, that was the Queen Mary.
The Queen Mary?
Yeah,
okay.
And they made a big...
the Ling also? Okay.
They had
some eardrums going here giving me clues of stuff. I was telling you earlier that we thought we had a ghost on the battleship New Jersey. One of our technicians was working down in Shaft Alley, which is about as low and as far back as you can get on the ship underwater. and he swore there were ghosts until after a few hours he realized that he was hearing whale calls from the Atlantic Ocean. We're 30 miles inland up the Delaware River. That was eerie in the beginning to hear these wooing sounds, and it's whales. Whales are good.
Well, you can hear that underwater for a long distance.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then the actual hull of the ship, if it had any sort of audio resonance at all, would almost make it a magnet for certain types of sounds.
And where Shaft Alley is, it's only a single hull. It's no outer torpedo defense system. So it was a great sounding board for those whale frequencies.
Now, let me ask you this. When you guys set up to do Museum Ships Weekend, what kind of equipment is on board these ships? What are they using? And, like, how many bands do they operate? Or is it typical? Is it everyone is different? Or tell me a little bit about that.
Every ship has different circumstances. Our requirements to be a ship on Museum Ships Weekend is, one, you have to operate from the ship, from the pier next to the ship, or you may be restricted to a parking lot, but you have to be within close sight of the ship. None of this being 5 miles away and saying you're at the ship. You have to actually be there. The equipment depends upon the curator of the ship, the radio club, the people doing the operating. It just might be one guy in his car at the foot of the pier with permission from the curator to be there. In the case of the battleship New Jersey, we have a great permanently installed amateur radio station. And we operate all bands, all modes, whatever is being supported by the people listening and trying to contact us.
And the reason I was asking, because I know on the Queen Mary, they've got this incredible installation inside the ship itself.
Yeah, pretty much the original operator's console.
And they've also got, a number of different antennas, antenna arrays on the outside of the ship. So I'm sure there's places they can't do that. I'm sure there's places. Is it a situation, or maybe the people that own the ship or have the ship as their property, whether it be a city or a county or an organization, they don't necessarily want people setting up radio equipment on the ship? I'm just wondering if you run into any of that at all.
You hit it right on the head, Ted. It's up to the people that have the responsibility of the ship. Some of them are still owned by the Navy. Some are privately owned, like the Keewatin is. The battleship New Jersey is still owned by the Navy and trusted to a local group. In our case, on the battleship New Jersey, we're allowed to do a lot of stuff except change the configuration, the silhouette of the ship. So hams love to have beams and Yagis and everything up. We can't. We're using the Navy antennas. But typically a ham's vertical antenna does not have 45,000 tons of steel under it for a ground plane or the entire Delaware River to act as a reflector to make the waves go further. So we're lucky there. Some of them are just simple, small wire antennas. Some have large antennas on the pier that they can use for only the day.
Well, you know, I guess the thing that that predicates this, and that is, how well do they understand what in the world amateur radio is?
Most of the curators do not. We were lucky that when we first reported to the battleship, we discovered that the curator, though not a ham, had a roommate at college that was a ham, and they actually came to Dayton Hamvention. So Scott Codger, the curator at the time, understood ham radio, what we could do. And if for no other reason, the public relations we can give by getting on the air and even just talking to the few million hams around the world, you'll get publicity, and it's free. All they have to do is say, yeah, we'll pay the little electric bill for you. And more of the curators, through their networking between themselves, are learning that ham radio can be a very good thing, either from publicity or the work the guys can do on their ships.
Well, one of the fellows that's here at the Dayton Hamvention this year, and hopefully he'll be by here to talk to us, is John Amadeo.
Yes.
And John is the producer. I was getting that microphone banging in my ears, and it was distracting me here. He's the producer of the television show Last Man Standing with Tim Allen. And I see situations like that where we have a golden opportunity for folks to get acquainted with what ham radio is, without the stigma.
Yes.
You know, the stigma that goes with ham radio sometimes is almost indelible.
Yes.
You know, so when something like that comes along, it's really cool, because then you have the opportunity to present the hobby. Okay, now let me ask you this. How can folks, this is June 1 and 2.
Saturday and Sunday, two weeks from today.
Should I say 2012 just to make my...
I don't know. Holly might come up and hit you on the backside like a Gibbs slap.
All right. 2013.
2013.
Obviously this year. June 1 and 2. It's the International Museums Ships Weekend. And this is... the website is what now? Here we've got...
www.nj2bb.org.
Okay. Now, that is a difficult URL to remember.
New Jersey 2 Big Battleship.
Now, that's easy to remember. New Jersey 2 Big Battleship.
That's it.
I bet if you Google it, it'll take you right straight to your website.
Google puts us right on top.
Okay, we'll see. I don't know what we're going to do without Google. If Google went away, boy, I'll tell you what, it would reduce the overall mentality of all of us to nothing.
Oh,
you know?
No kidding.
There used to be Encyclopedia Britannica, and you had to get the updates every year. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, with Google, it makes all that obsolete. But if Google, maybe we all ought to go out and get some Encyclopedia Britannica.
But they're not made anymore. They're out of publication.
Put them in the house and keep them like a generator. You know, that's what we got to do. Thank you so much for coming by.
Well, thank you, Ted. It's been a pleasure.
And I want folks to that are. Even if you're just if you're a shortwave listener, you're not even a ham. The other thing is, with the website, are you all over the bands, or are you in specific places?
We would like to say that just come up on a certain frequency and all the ships would be there, but that's just logistically impossible. Propagation won't allow it. Just tune around the bands, and if you find a ship and you make a QSO with it, hang around for a little bit. Somebody will come around and say, oh, I just worked another ship up 10 KCs or at the other end of the band. If you're into the DX clusters and spottings, bring it up and keep it there.
I would think, yeah, as you're tuning up and down, as best I can remember on Museum Ships Weekend, there are pileups.
Yes.
So look for the pileups.
And I got to say one thing. I tell everybody when I mention that this is not a contest. It's a special event station from 93 different places. There'll be pileups, just like you said. Being on the battleship New Jersey, there'll be dozens and dozens of hams calling. As soon as one of them says, hey, I was in Vietnam and you guys saved my butt, the band goes quiet. I hope it's for respect, but everybody wants to hear the story. And then as soon as the story's over, it's what hams expect a pileup to be like. Madhouse conversations. But if SSWLR, shortwave listener, here's the ship. Send them a card. Most of them will send you back a card. Nice color card of the ship and what's been going on. We like shortwave listeners. Someday they'll become a ham.
There you go. That's what our goal is here, is to turn every shortwave listener into a licensed ham.
Hey, it's the best hobby in the world. There's something for everybody.
All righty. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you coming by. International Museum Ships Weekend is June 1 and 2. Of course, this year, 2013. And the website is, let me see if I can say, www.NewJerseyNJ2BB, or like New Jersey 2 Big Battleship.
.org.
If you get lost, put in International Museum Ships Weekend into Google, and they will escort you there.
It'll be right there.
All righty. Well,
thanks
so much. Appreciate you stopping by.
Okay.
Now, I've got two folks sitting here. One fellow here from AMSAT, and the other fellow here, which I think he probably has to get back to his booth real quick, and that is the unseen bean. We have Jerry with us here. How are you? How's it going?
Doing real well.
Mic's off. We got to just build a fire under David here to make sure these mics are on. You can turn the other ones off. There's a lot of crowd noise in here, so we have to shut what mics off we're not using, or else it sounds like.
It's on.
There we go.
I'm Jerry Leary from the Unseen Bean.
Okay, well, you need to talk into the front of that thing.
I'm used to older microphones where you cross-talk them. Okay. Sorry about that.
Now, we run commercials for you, and I'm telling you, we talk about your coffee, and I think the ad goes something like, is it possible for a blind coffee roaster to produce the best-tasting coffee that we've ever tasted? And the answer is yes, it is. And I think this is the most, Jerry is the most amazing, unusual fella, talented, He's an amateur radio operator. He is a shortwave listener, and he, I'm telling you, he roasts coffee that's out of this world. So I don't know if I want to ask you to tell us your secret or...
Well, I don't mind telling you my secret. I roast coffee by sound and smell. I use a rotating coffee roaster that tumbles the coffee beans, similar to a clothing dryer. And as it goes through the roast, the beans that tumble in the roaster sound different as they get hotter. And they also smell different as they get hotter. And when you roast coffee, it doesn't really smell like it tastes. And it doesn't smell like it smells after it's cooled and in the bag. So when I started roasting coffee, I started with a quarter-pound roaster. And I ran that way for a year till I accumulated enough money to buy my large roaster. And with every roast that I did, I would take some out of it and brew a pot of coffee and then log the results. And so I built my knowledge of coffee roasting by what the coffee smelled like when it was roasting, what it sounded like inside of the roaster, and I wasn't able to look at the color of the beans at all since I have no vision. And so once I got done roasting, when I found a roast that worked right, then I would ask people to describe the beans to me so that I could describe them to others. And as a result of that, I developed what's called the blind roasting process. And as far as I know, I'm the only one in the country that sells blind roasted coffee, which means it's coffee that wasn't looked at during or after the process. And it took me a while to develop that because, like I say, coffee smells basically three different ways. One way when it's raw in the green bean form, one way while it's roasting, and then one way after it cools and it's ready for the consumer.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I have so many people will say to me, they'll say, well, because they know I'm a coffee drinker, and they'll say, well, yeah, you know, I love the way coffee smells when it's brewing, but I just don't like the way it tastes. And I say, you're drinking the wrong coffee. when you go to the supermarket, you buy a can of coffee, you take it home. That's true. You brew it. Boy, it smells good. You take a sip, and it's like, ah, what is wrong with this? You know, so, but now, like with your coffee, it may smell slightly different than it tastes, but the aroma that you smell when it's brewing, when you take a sip of that, and it goes in your mouth, and of course, you know, the sense of smell has an awful lot to do with taste. It's in other words, what you're smelling is what you are tasting. And then there's no disappointment in a cup of coffee.
Well, that's what I try to roast to. I try to make it taste like it smells. And one of the things that I have found in my roasting techniques, normally when coffee roasters cup coffee, there's a ritual and a process that they go through where you take about a 6-ounce glass, you put about a quarter ounce of coffee in there, about 7 or 8 grams, and then you pour water over it. You let it sit for a while, about 4 or 5 minutes. You sniff it. You break the crust on the coffee and push the coffee down into the water with a spoon. You sniff it again, and then you ladle a spoonful of the water off of the top and slurp it so that you get enough air in there to get all of the olfactory and the taste all at once and drink it that way. Well, that's a great formal way to cup coffee. It brings out a lot of different tastes in coffee. But it doesn't do the same thing as brewing it in a coffee pot or a French press or a percolator does. And so when I cup coffee at the Unseen Bean, when we roast, we go over to our drip coffee maker that we bought at Kmart or one of those places, and we brew up a pot of coffee and see how it tastes, because we want to make the coffee just like you do at home. So we don't treat it any differently than you do. And thusly, when you drink a cup of coffee at either of our cafes, you can take some of it and go home, and it'll taste just like it did at the coffee shop.
All right, now here's a question. If I take a cup of your coffee and put it, say, for example, in an aluminum coffee cup, thermal coffee cup, okay, And I put it in there, put the cap on it, and I drink a little bit about it, and I forget about it. Okay, so it's still sitting in the cup. All right, now, I can go 4 or 5 hours later and take a sip of that coffee, and it tastes good. I mean, it's still, it's not hot, but it, I mean, the flavor is still there, the aroma is still there. Now, if I brew a pot of coffee at home and pour it in a cup, or if I brew a pot of coffee at home and it even sits in the pot for 15 or 20 minutes, it's to the point I can't drink it. I think it has a foul smell, a foul taste. And if it sits in a cup, it does exactly the same thing. Now, what's the difference? Why is that?
Two things. One, I use a specialty coffee. I use Arabica coffee, and I only use high-altitude Arabica coffee, which is called hard bean coffee. And the reason that I do that is because the coffee that you get when you brew it is much more stable. And so coffee is affected by a lot. Brewed coffee, which is a liquid, has remnants of the coffee bean in it. And so it has all of the chemistry that wants to separate from the coffee bean. And if you can keep most of the oil in the bean, and if you can keep most of the acids in the bean, then they won't come out when you brew the coffee. So when you roast, you need to not let it get too dark. You need to not let it get too hot. And you need to let it take long enough to roast that you don't break down the structure of the bean. And that way, when you brew the coffee, all of the acids, most of the oil, and some of the other chemistry stays in the coffee grounds rather than separating. And so therefore, you get only the caffeine and the taste, and you don't get the acid and you don't get the bitterness. Generally in coffee, bitterness is caused by a multitude of things, but the three biggest things are how much oil has been roasted out of the bean, and how hot the bean has gotten, and how fast it's cooled. So the faster you cool coffee, the less bitter it will taste. And if you roast it without getting it too hot so that you get the oil on the outsides of it, that will help too. That'll help make it less bitter. So when you're looking in the stores at bags of coffee or whole bean coffee in a bin, the shiny, oily coffee isn't really what you want. You want the coffee to come out of the roaster and go into the bags where it's not oily yet. And if you have had coffee around for a while, let's say you buy a bag of whole bean coffee, you may notice that after it gets to be a month or two old, it starts getting shiny, and that's because the coffee deteriorates. So it's like steel. It oxidizes or rusts, and it deteriorates from the outside in. And as the coffee oxidizes, it also breaks down and separates. And,
well, you know, I used to buy coffee, well, this before we had met you, but I would go. There was a place in Nashville. Oh, what was it called? Bongo Java. That was the name of the place, Bongo Java. It's down by the college. And you'd go in, and they have these great, big, gigantic black beans, and it looked like they were covered with 40-weight motor oil.
Mm-hmm.
And I would take those things home and grind them, and it was unbelievable. It was the best coffee I had drank that I had been able to procure in Nashville. And I noticed that when I got to coffee that had no oil on it at all, like if you'd see a bunch of beans and they just looked dry, it just didn't seem to have the gusto. So I felt like the oil must have something to do with the way the thing was roasted, and the oil must have something to do with the flavor of the coffee somehow. So I mean, and I imagine it's all a delicate balance, and you know all this, and I don't. So I was just asking.
Well, some of this has to do also with the type of beans that are used. Now, some coffee beans, some Robusta beans, and some of the softer bean coffees will always oil when you roast them, and you can't stop that. So as long as you don't burn the coffee, you can draw the sugars out of the coffee, and they'll come out with the oils, and then when they go into the coffee pot, they'll actually taste good, and they'll give the coffee sort of a caramel or a maple syrup taste. And that's something you have to be careful with, and something you have to experiment with, because when you bring a coffee up to the temperature that it needs to come up to oil, if you go 2 or 3 degrees too high, you burn it. If you go 2 or 3 degrees too low, the sugar stays in the bean and it doesn't come out with the oil. So that's why in some situations, oily coffees are actually really good tasting. And I know I contradict myself in some ways by saying that, but that's something you'll have to experiment with when you go into the markets or coffee shops and play with the different coffees, grind them a little different, brew them stronger and weaker, because all of those things have a definite difference in the way the coffee tastes.
Now, what's better, a coffee pot? Let's say you're using a drip type thing, like almost like a Mr. Coffee or a bun. Now, David, my son David, KG4WXW, he uses nothing but a French press, and when he gets done with it, it does look like motor oil after a diesel engine has been drained for an oil change. Okay, that's what he drinks, and he loves it, you know. And I think anyone else would be climbing the walls from the caffeine. They'd just be, you know, they'd be climbing the walls. But for the typical coffee drinker, what's better, hotter, a hotter brew, or a little less heat on the brew?
You want the coffee to brew with water. If you're in a perfect world, you want the water to be just before boiling. If you actually boil the water, you start separating it, and it actually changes the composition of the water a little bit, and it can burn the coffee, and it can bring out bitter tastes. Now, the secret here is, it's not necessarily the temperature, it's the boiling factor. So whether you're at sea level or 10,000 feet, you really don't want the coffee to come to a boil. The second thing to think about is, when you're at sea level, coffee boils at about, or water boils at about 212, and it starts to boil at a lower temperature as you go up in altitude. If you put boiling water at sea level into coffee, you're going to burn it, and it's going to taste burnt. If you put simmering water at over coffee at sea level, it won't burn it. And generally, as long as you keep your temperature under 195, you're in good shape. Our coffee pots at both of our locations brew at 192 degrees because that's hot enough to get the sugars to separate from the bean. So you get the sweetness of the coffee, but it's cool enough not to burn the coffee. And interestingly enough, when you roast coffee, if you're talking about one particular bean, the longer or hotter you roast it, the more caffeine you cook out of it. So the darker the coffee is, when you're speaking of the same type of coffee, the less caffeine is in it. Now, some coffees will work better darker than others. Robusta coffee, for instance, can't roast as hot as Arabica coffee, so you have to be careful because Robusta coffee is easy to burn. But Robusta coffee also has more caffeine than Arabica coffee. So sometimes when people create espresso blends, they'll put a little bit of Robusta in it because it really, really kicks the caffeine up higher.
But now espresso, in an espresso maker, you have water boiling, and then it goes into steam, and the steam violently goes through the top and goes through the beans and comes out the little spigot on the side. Hopefully, if the seal doesn't break, you don't lose the lid and send the top of the maker through the ceiling.
I've done it.
So, anyways, I was wondering, that's a lot of heat, though, in espresso.
That is. That's why not every coffee works well as espresso. A lot of the better companies will use different beans for espresso than they will for drip coffee. At the Unseen Bean, we use Arabica for all of our coffee, so most of our coffees will work really well for either drip or espresso. But the thing with espresso coffee is that hot water that's being forced through the coffee beans doesn't stay in the beans very long. It all gets pushed through. So what it does is it extracts all of the things that you want from the coffee, but it doesn't stay in the coffee long enough to take on all of the oils and all of the acidity that you would get if you soaked the beans for a long time.
Now, there's going to be a test after this, Jerry.
It'll be a one-question test. We aren't sure what it is yet.
Well, yeah, I have one more question for you. I don't want to wear you out because I know you got to get back to your booth. But here's my question, and that is, what is the difference? Like, for example, you obviously probably sell decaf coffee.
Yep.
Okay. How is it different than regular coffee, and how much caffeine is actually in it? And I can tell you why. I've gone a couple of places, and I said, I want a cup of decaf coffee. This is back when I had sworn off caffeine. And actually, I swore off caffeine again. Once you swear off of caffeine, a half a cup of caffeinated coffee can send you to Jitterville, okay? But then if you kind of keep drinking it a little bit, you can wean yourself back onto the caffeine. So when you wake up in the morning, you feel dead. And until you have two cups of coffee, then you start to come to life again. but what is the difference between the two? What's the distinction between decaffeinated and caffeinated coffee?
To decaffeinate coffee, there's several processes, and I'm only familiar with one, which is called Swiss water process. And the reason I am familiar with that one in particular is because with my decaf coffees, I only use organic decaf, and the Swiss water process doesn't really add chemistry to it. But what they do is they tumble it in a machine like a dryer, and they spray high-pressure water at the green beans. So this is when the beans are raw. It strips the outer layer of the bean off where 99% of the caffeine is. And then the rest of the bean is then coated with a very, very, very thin layer of what they call food-grade wax. And this wax seals the bean because the outer layer of the bean keeps the insides of the bean from degrading. And this wax burns off when you first drop the coffee into the roaster, so as a consumer, you never see any of it. But the Swiss water process leaves the least amount of degradation to the coffee bean. It doesn't add anything to it, and it doesn't disturb the taste.
Well, the reason why I ask is I've been told and I have read that when you drink decaf coffee, you're getting formaldehyde in your system. And I thought, wow, that doesn't sound very good.
There are some coffees that are processed that way. They're run through a formaldehyde bath that's got a few other chemicals in it, and that strips the outer layer of bean off of it. And the advantage to that process is that it's cheaper, it's faster, and it can take even more of the caffeine out of the bean. The disadvantage to that process is that the chemistry that has the formaldehyde in it also soaks into the bean, and so yes, you do get some. I don't know what the percentages are.
Okay, so what this means then, and that is, if you are a heavy coffee drinker, you drink decaf coffee that's been processed with formaldehyde. When you die, you do not need embalming. Is that correct?
Well, I think it heads in that direction, but I don't know that I don't know that you get that much caffeine.
Now, what type of decaf do you sell? Obviously, I would think you sell the first type you were talking about.
We sell Swiss water processed decaf. It's all organic. We generally have two types. We have a decaf Peru organic and a decaf Sumatra organic. And as my company grows and we become more financially affluent, we'll have more and more organic decaf. But we have these two right now. And the reason I chose these two is because they're easily available without being horribly expensive. Most of our coffee beans raw cost me over $5 a pound plus shipping. It's because I usually get washed beans. I generally get a lot of organics. Some of the Africans I can't get as organic, but I usually get grade 1 beans or double A beans. And I do that because, like anything else, the better the raw product, the better the finished product.
You know, I'll tell you something. Like I said, we run We run spots for you on the radio here. This the Unseen Bean advertises with us here, and every year at Dayton we have a chance to get Jerry over here to the microphone for a few minutes. I do, because he just knows so much about coffee, and there's so many folks drink coffee. I mean, you know, I guess there's probably literally gallons consumed on field day.
Oh yeah,
you know, and as hams, I think a lot of times late night in the shack, you got to have a cup of coffee. So. I'd like everybody that's listening right now, I'm going to have Jerry give you a website address. I want you to go up there, and I want you to at least try his coffee, because if you do, you'll be converted. This will be like a religious experience. You're going to go through a type of conversion, all right? Because the stuff that comes from the Unseen Bean is the most incredible coffee I've ever drank. I mean, I've never had anything better, let's put it that way. And I know at the house, every once in a while, we run out. And when we do, you know, I'm always saying, well, why can't we get some decent coffee? And God forbid you go to the grocery store and buy some of that junk in a can. Oh, my heavens, you know. I mean, I can't tell the difference between it and tea, you know. Yeah.
And here's why. So if you were to take coffee that came out of a roaster and put it into a sealed bag, that bag would inflate and pressurize itself because the coffee automatically starts to oxidize. So you can't draw a vacuum on fresh coffee. Unless you completely remove all of the oxygen from the coffee and what it's contained in, it will always oxidize or gas off, and it will always build pressure in the container. And now there are two main processes that you can go through to stop that. One is to nitrogen immerse the coffee, which means you completely fill the container with nitrogen gas, and that will put a barrier between the oxygen in the coffee and the rest of the coffee, and therefore it'll stop the oxidation process pretty much. The other way is to do what they call staling, which means you make the coffee stale. And the way that's done is once it comes out of the roaster, it's put in a situation where it encounters high pressure air and water. The water adds a little bit of weight to the bean, and the air helps to oxidize the bean completely so that it no longer gases off. Then you can pull a vacuum on the coffee. Well, what happens next after that is then they coat the coffee with a chemical concoction that has coffee aroma in it. So when you first open a can of canned coffee, it will smell really good, but you'll notice that when you take the top off of it the next day, it smells different. And that's because you've exposed all that coffee to air once again, and so it can then continue to oxidize, as well as all of the aroma that was sprayed on that coffee before it was put in the can dissipates, evaporates, and then you actually smell the beans as they are.
It's kind of like the aerosol new car smell.
Yes.
That they spray inside of used cars to make you feel good when you buy them.
And I'll tell you, you know, speaking of markets, this is something that only happened a week ago. The Whole Foods market system just took on our coffee. We're in one store in Boulder, Colorado. And if you don't want to order the Unseen Bean online, you can go if you have a Whole Foods market in your area and request coffee from the Unseen Bean, and they'll order it from us. And when you get coffee from the market, that the Unseen Bean coffee anyway, it has the date that it was roasted on the front of the package. We say, I was roasted on May 15th, 2013. And coffee, generally, if you don't get it hot and you don't expose it to a lot of air, we sell it in a bag that has a one-way valve in it so that when it gases off, it can relieve that oxygen and that pressure from the bag, but it can't take on new air. That coffee can stay good for a month or two.
You know what? I always thought those little valves on the coffee bags so you could squeeze them and smell them.
That, too.
You go in the supermarket, pull that thing out and mash that bag and go, oh, my God, does that smell good, you know? Mm-hmm. So, anyways, well, listen, Jerry, thank you so much for coming by and talking with us. And let's get the website so the folks can know exactly where to go to to order coffee?
If you want to get our coffee online, you can go to theunseenbean.com, and that is myself, and you can order it there, or you can drop us an email and tell me to call you, or you can get our phone number and call us up. We take the major credit cards, whether it's online or on the phone. We do it both ways. And we even have some customers that mail us our coffee orders, and we mail them back, and they send us a check. I want to thank everyone at Hamvention, because I sold out yesterday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
See, folks have gotten to know this man's coffee here, and they look for him. I mean, David, my son David, the first thing he looks for, he comes in here, where's the Unseen Bean? Where's he at? Is he here this year? Is he going to be here? I need to get some coffee. You know? So, and that's what's happening. But the thing of it is all you really have to do, I suppose, all you have to do is pick up the phone and call. You could probably order by phone and
get
a credit card number, and you're good to go.
Oh, yeah. And plus the fact, if you attended the Dayton Hamvention and you call me on the phone and you let me know that you were at Hamvention, I'll sell you coffee for Hamvention prices, which is $2 less than what it goes for in the markets.
Wow. That's a good deal. But you see now, you got a lot of people listening to the radio that's never been here. But they're going to say they came to the Hamvention, you know.
If they tell me that they heard this on the QSO radio show, they'll get the same discount.
Okay, there
we
you
don't,
go.
We don't do it online. You have to call us up. I'm sorry about that. I don't have the web engineering to make that happen yet. But if you call the Unseen Bean or drop us an email and tell us that you heard us on the QSO radio show, or that you were at the Dayton Hamvention, or give me your call sign, we'll extend it to you that way, too.
Oh, we really appreciate it. Once again, unseenbean.com, and we appreciate you, Jerry. Your call sign again. Give everybody.
I am WB6IVF. That's Washboard 6 is very famous. We're at theunseenbean.com in Boulder, Colorado. And we sure appreciate the QSO radio show. And try some of our kilowatt coffee or contesters blend one day.
There you go. You don't make any QRP coffee, though.
We do. We do make a QRP blend.
Is it weak?
No, it's decaffeinated.
Okay, there you go. All right, Jerry, thank you so much.
And thank you, Ted, for the wonderful show and the wonderful interview.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, this broadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2013 is brought to you by Hamtest Online. And we'll be back with more of Hamvention 2013 right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either, there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Hamtest Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Hamtest Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamtestOnline.com. That's HamtestOnline.com. We want to thank you for listening to the QSO Radio Show. But we'd also like to remind you, it's so important that we hear from you. Please shoot us an email and say hello. Tell us where you're listening and what you're listening on. If you have a suggestion for a guest, be sure and mention that in your email and send it our way. You can do that by simply going to our website, and that's QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com, or look for the tab on the website that says Contact Ted, and then send your email. Mention on your email, I want to win, because we would like to make it worth your while for sending us an email, and we try to respond to as many as we possibly can. Also, you want to check out the streaming on the website. We have the QSO Radio stream that runs 24/7 with all the older QSO shows, along with Glenn Hauser's World of Radio, a very comprehensive broadcast that covers the entire gamut of shortwave broadcasting, something like you've never heard. If you're into propagation and shortwave listening, you're going to get hooked on this program. Plus, the very wonderful Amateur Radio Newsline. And we repeat these shows about 6 times a day. So regardless of what time you click on the stream, if you listen for a while, you're going to catch up on everything. We really appreciate you listening, and we'd like to also invite you to follow us on Twitter and also friend us on Facebook. It's all under QSO Radio Show. Once again, thank you for listening to QSO. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to a rebroadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2013, brought to you by Hamtest Online. And now, back to the Hamvention. This is the QSO Radio Show, coming to you live. Now, if you've never heard a live broadcast on shortwave radio, this is live. And we're on WBCQ on 9330, courtesy of the Good Friends Radio Network, Rod Hembry and Alan Weiner, the owner of WBCQ. And we're also on WTWW, just outside of Music City, USA, Nashville, Tennessee. And that radio station is broadcasting. We are on 9930. So I would have to say, in my estimation, not just because we're on them, these are really and truly the best shortwave radio facilities in the United States of America. So if you're listening, wherever you're listening in, that's what's going on. Now, with me right now, I was looking at the call sign, KB1SF. Keith is with us, and he is with AMSAT. And
hello, Ted.
Your mic's actually on. Okay.
Yes, it is. This has been wonderful experience and coffee. Everything you ever wanted to know about coffee. You know, this is the fun part about amateur radio, is you run into people that have interesting vocations where your amateur radio is the avocation, but yet some of the things that people do that are ham operators is just amazing. It literally from all walks of life. So I was all set to get up here and go over and get some coffee until he said he sold out. So
I know.
I was all ready to leave. Oh, wow. A fantastic experience.
I can remember one of the very first years that we were here that Jerry was here, and he was brewing coffee as well as selling bags of coffee, and he has these little dark chocolate candy bars that have ground up espresso beans in them. And I can't get near one of those. They're small, I will say that. They're not a huge candy bar, but they are, I mean, they are just out of this world.
Amazing. Amazing. So, yeah, I really, really enjoyed that. That was fantastic.
Now, you you had a banquet last night.
Yes, we did.
And I don't know. See, I don't know anything about what goes on at those banquets.
Well, we have, every year we have here at Hamvention, there's two groups. One is called Tapper, which is the Tucson Amateur Packet Radio Group. And, of course, AMSAT, which is the Radio Amateur Satellite Corporation. We go together, and one year we'll the AMSAT group will sponsor the dinner. And then in opposite years, in the next year, the Tapper group. And so it was the Tapper group's turn to set the dinner up. And they also had the guest speaker for us. So, yes, it was an interesting experience. That's the other thing about Hamvention is there's so many of these things going on. You know, a good friend of mine is into 160-meter operation, and he was up at the top band dinner. There's the DX dinner. There's just all these groups that get together, and it's unfortunate that we're only here for 3 days because you want to go to all of these things.
I was going to say, what happens if some guy's into satellite communication? He wants to go to that dinner, and he also wants to go to the top band dinner.
Well, he has to flip a coin.
160-meter, yeah. You know.
Anyway, but it's that's the fun part about Hamvention is that. And you never know who you're going to run into or who you're going to talk to or who's going to give us a forum speech on something. So anyway, we're here to talk about what our next project. We are the Amateur Satellite Corporation called AMSAT. We're dedicated to building and launching our own fleet of amateur radio satellites that are available for anyone with a license to use. We're very happy right now. We just found out before we came that we do have a launch, a firm launch date now for our little small CubeSat, which I brought a model here. It's too bad this isn't television, but this is a full-size model of our Fox satellite. It will have a different name once it gets into orbit. But essentially, you can see if you look inside, you can see there's circuit boards. This thing is about 3 inches on a side. It's a cube.
I'm holding this in my hand, and I'm trying to think what it is that it's about the size of. It's a little smaller than the average size computer speaker.
Something like that.
Not the subwoofer, but one of the side speakers.
It's a Rubik's Cube on steroids.
It's a little bit larger than a Rubik's Cube, and I'm holding it in my hand. It says FoxSat 1. Yeah. Now, this thing, now let me ask you a question. Once this is launched, is this out in space all by itself?
It is exactly that. It will be in orbit, in its own orbit. We're hoping the orbit that, and we do have a launch for it, courtesy of NASA. We're looking, I believe, at about a 67-degree inclination orbit, which, for those people that aren't familiar with that, it means that its angle to the equator is about 67 degrees, which means it'll be coming over North America, it'll be going over Europe and South America.
What are the little panels on the sides here?
Those are the solar cells.
Okay, and then where would the antenna be?
The antenna will pop out of one of the solar cells. It'll be a quarter-wave whip for VHF and another one on the bottom for UHF. So essentially what you're holding in your hand is a repeater, a crossband repeater, and that's what it will be.
Okay, so this will receive on...
It will be receiving on 435 megahertz, which is our 440 or 70-centimeter band.
Okay.
And it will be transmitting whatever it hears on the downlink, which will be on 2 meters, which is 145 megahertz, something like that.
We've got some folks taking pictures, but I want to shoot a picture with my cell camera.
We'll do that. This is full size, by the way. This is not a model. This is the full size.
It's hard to believe. This thing is going to be out in space, tumbling along.
Yep.
I move it up a little bit closer to my cell phone here because I'm gonna get a little picture. What's weird is it's making the camera's making it look bigger than what it is. I was trying to think of something we could set it next to. Okay, wait a minute.
Here we go.
A Sprite can.
We'll put it on a Sprite can. Don't put it on your. There we go.
I don't want to do it on the console.
No, that's probably not a good idea. Yeah. There we go.
But looking at it in terms of.
Now, this is our engineering model. Obviously, this will be covered with solar cells. These each one of these little solar cells generates about a watt of power. The transmitter will be transmitting with about 400 milliwatts of power, which is more than enough from the altitude where the satellite will be, that you should be able, if you have a dual-band handheld, for example, you should be able to at least hear it. And if you have a little bit of a gain on your antenna on the uplink, you should be able to actually talk through it. So, and you'll also notice that there's about 10 circuit boards, and they're all kind of stacked. It looks like a stacked arrangement inside. One of those, of course, will be the transmitter. One will be the receiver. Right in the middle, you'll notice that there's a little bit of extra space. That's where the batteries will go. And we're using, believe it or not, ordinary NICATs for that satellite. And we're hoping that the satellite will be up there for about 11 to 12 years. And if for some reason the battery crumps out, which is one of the big problems that we have in space, because you have to remember when this thing is in orbit, as it goes around the Earth, when it's in full sun, it's baking at about 250 degrees Celsius. And when it's in shade, it's minus 250 degrees Celsius.
Now, let me ask you a question. What is the cost of that little cube right there?
The cost to put it together in terms of our out-of-pocket costs are about $30,000, roughly.
$30,000.
$30,000. And most of it is in the solar panels.
Really?
Those little solar cells are very, very expensive. Now, the labor cost is all being done by volunteers. So if we were to put this together, you're talking probably $1 million, something like that. But because it's all donated, we have to pay for parts. The other thing that's nice about this is that we can build two or three or four of them, and if one happens to not work, we say, well, okay, if it ends up in a sub-Atlantic orbit, sometimes that's happened. We end up, the thing doesn't get it to orbit. Usually the launch agency will give us another launch, so we just pull out the backup satellite and give it to them, and away they go. This whole design, they're called CubeSats, was the brainchild of one of our ham radio operator friends, and another gentleman that he worked with, a fellow by the name of Bob Twiggs, who's now down at Morehead State University. Bob has done a lot of work for us in AMSAT. Came up with this concept, and a lot of agencies now are getting on the bandwagon, including the Department of Defense and, you know, a lot of the government agencies. So here again, this is an actual living issue of where, you know, amateur radio has built something that ends up at some point in being useful in other places.
Well, I guess what astounds me is the size of this thing. In other words, it's little.
Yeah.
And what's the biggest enemy to these things in space? Once they're up there and they're orbiting, I'm going to get a picture of all you guys standing around here. They're up and orbiting. What's the enemy?
Biggest enemy is the environment that it's in. Because you have to remember, you're putting this thing into an airless environment. So the only way that you can get heat around inside is by direct contact. You know, a heat sink doesn't work. A fan doesn't work. You know, we have fans in our computers. We have fans in our radios. We have heat sinks in our radios. That doesn't work. So the biggest problem that we're facing with this is keeping the batteries warm, because there's not a whole lot of cross-sectional area here to heat the batteries and keep them nice and toasty. And if you have a camera, you ever been outside with a new camera with a battery in a cold weather, you know it doesn't work very well. So we're actually going to have to put heaters around our batteries to keep them nice and toasty as the satellite goes through what we call eclipse, when it goes around the other side of the Earth.
Typically, the batteries that are in there, in other words, as this thing goes around the Earth, it's going in light and then it goes into darkness.
That's right. It charges in the light, and we'll also be operating it in the light. So you've got a dual purpose of the solar cells. They charge the battery, but they also operate the transmitter and the receiver and the computer that's inside. So the batteries have to be able to power the spacecraft as it goes around the Earth on the other side, and that's about a 45-minute window, because it's about an hour and a half orbit. So you're 45 minutes baking in the sun and 45 minutes freezing in the dark. So that takes a toll on your batteries. Now, one of the other things that we've built into this is a situation whereby if we lose the batteries, the satellite will continue to work as long as it's in sunlight.
And, of course, then when it goes into darkness, it stops working.
That's right. And we're calling that the zombie sat mode.
That's incredible. Now, let me ask you, how many simultaneous conversations could be on this satellite?
On this satellite, it's going to be essentially what you have for a repeater. It's going to be basically a single channel. So that means that you will have one person, theoretically, you'll have one person in the transponder at a time. And most of the contacts that you make on these sorts of satellites, because this is an FM satellite, which most people have a radio that will work on crossband on 2 meters and 70 centimeters. Most of the time, it's hello, Joe, how are you? Hey, great, good morning, and then somebody else will come in. So it's a one at a time. But imagine your local repeater in a 500-mile orbit, and that's kind of what you've got. So
now, the other satellites I've seen, the ones that have been on display, are a lot bigger than that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so is this a result of higher technology and miniaturization, or is this a scaled-down version of some of the larger satellites that you see pictures of?
It's predominantly due to the miniaturization, and also it's predominantly due to the cost of lifting the mass to orbit. Because the less mass you have, the less rocket fuel you need. And so the fact that we've been able to, and you know, this is the same sort of technology that's in your cell phones and in your smartphones, where you've got little teeny surface mount technology that's been put on these boards that's taken the place of what years ago would be transistors or even tubes, you know.
Yeah, and I look at surface mount circuit boards, and I just kind of wonder, how do they work on them? Maybe when I was younger, I could.
Well,
a big, huge magnifying glass
absolutely.
And a light, you can do it. You know?
And we've got folks, God love them, we've got folks, our volunteers, that do this for us. They that's how they have to work on them. And in fact, with one of our we've got our computer board out there, and you can stop in at the booth at the AMSAT booth and take a look at it. And it's an eye test, I'll tell you. In fact, if you look there, you can see one of the connectors that's got 58 pins to it.
Oh, wow.
And it's about the size of your thumbnail.
I was going to say, now let's talk about satellites just for a moment from the standpoint. And I know we talked about this before, but folks that are saying, you know, I'd kind of like to get involved in this, but I don't know how to do it. I don't even know where to start. And gosh, how complicated is it? Could I figure this out? Could I get on the air and do this?
Yes, you can.
So why don't you give us a little rundown on that?
The first thing is, if you have some way to communicate by way of 70 centimeters or 440 band, and also on 2 meters, this can be a handheld. This can be two handhelds. One can be a scanner for the receive side. Some folks have used some of these little QRP rigs that Yaesu makes, for example, the 817. You will use two of those. As far as the equipment is concerned, the antenna can be made out of blocks of wood and pieces of coat hangers.
Now, when you're talking about the 817, though, isn't that an HF rig?
Yes, it is, but it also has VHF and UHF capability.
I didn't know
all
that.
Mode. Okay, it'll do FM, and it will also do sideband and CW. So you can have those sorts of radios. And like I said, the downlink can be picked up on a scanner. People sometimes will use their FM handy talkie to talk up to the satellite, and then they receive it on a regular Bearcat scanner for the downlink. The antennas can be, you need a little bit of gain. You can do it on a rubber duck. I have actually communicated through some of our FM satellites using a little rubber ducky thing. But that's kind of hit or miss, and that's usually for passes that are more or less right overhead. Sometimes you need a little bit more gain. So a small three-element, for example, on 2-meter radio, on the 2-meter band, and maybe a 4- or 5-element antenna for 70 centimeters, very small, doesn't have to be anything fancy, is what you need. And you can hand move that. You can have somebody else move it. You can build yourself a little Azel rotor system if you want to, rotator system. we've built some stuff out of old TV rotors, for example. So it's fairly simple to do. If you just want to listen, you can go out in your backyard with your handheld and listen to the satellite as it comes over. So we've done that. Anyway, there's a lot of information on our website. And
if you're listening on a handheld in the backyard,
yeah,
and all you have is a rubber duck, and you say, I just want to hear this. I want to hear what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to hear on a rubber duck on an HT standing in your backyard?
You're going to hear a couple of satellites that are already up there. Once we launch this one, you'll hear this one as well. It's on the downlinks are usually on the 145 megahertz portion of our 2 meter ham band. The information, there's a lot of information up on our website as to exactly what frequencies to listen to. At one time we had some tracking, you could put in your latitude and longitude or your Maidenhead grid square and plug that in, and it would give you a set of as-el information that would tell you, where do I point my antenna? But we have, like I said, we have a lot of information on our website.
Well, yeah, there's apps on the cell phones now. You
know, absolutely.
I've got a couple of them on the Android.
You can do satellite tracking.
And it'll tell you what's coming over, and you can actually set an alarm. It'll go, tell you that such and such is coming over.
Yep.
So when you determine that you got this satellite passing over, I guess my question is you don't, what you're saying is you don't necessarily have to have a tracking directional array and all that kind of stuff.
No.
I see these cute little handheld Yagis that are like crisscrossed. How do those work?
They work very well. One of them is made by a gentleman out in Wyoming called Arrow. They're called Arrow antennas. He makes them out of arrow shafts. Very nicely machined system, and I think he's on the internet as well, and I think I'm pretty sure he's still making them. We also have another antenna. It's a log periodic design handheld by an organization called Elk Antennas, and we offer some of those for a donation in our booth, but you can also order online or you can make your own. There's a lot of plans on the internet for in fact, our gentleman is out in the parking lot here with a set of crossed Yagis for 2 meters and 70 centimeters made out of coat hangers on a boom made out of wood.
Now you were talking about this Elk antenna. No, mm-hmm. is this something that you folks actually stock or carry?
Yes.
Or,
okay. Yes, we do.
All right.
And you can also buy them online, I believe, as well.
And about what do they sell for?
Oh, $100.
$100
something in that order.
And what do they look like? How large are they?
They're the Elk antenna would be probably about a 3 feet long and maybe a little bit 2 feet wide. Like I said, it's a log periodic design with a handle on it. The Arrow antenna is about the same, a little bit longer, but they're very nicely collapsible. They break down into something you can throw into a suitcase. In fact, a lot of folks do that if they're traveling. They'll take along one of these antennas, and when they have a set of predictions as to when the particular satellite is going to be above the horizon, they'll put the antenna up, get out there with their handheld, and away they go. A lot of folks like to work Maidenhead grid squares and collect them by moving around from one place to the other through the satellites. There's a lot of folks doing that.
This is all real interesting, and I think the thing is I think what goes through a lot of folks' mind when you say satellite communications, they think.
That's got to be complicated.
Yeah, complicated communication.
It's not.
But it's got to be a thrill and extremely entertaining.
Absolutely. The other thing that's nice about satellite communications is that if you're working the satellite in what we call full duplex mode, where you're actually hearing the downlink, you'll hear yourself. And you'll hear yourself come through the satellite transponder as well as the other person that you're talking to. So you'll know that you're actually getting into the satellite because you're hearing yourself. And in some cases, we've had, with our big high-altitude satellites, we've had where we've been out at 20,000 kilometers or so, you actually start to hear the speed of light delay. And that gets a little bit complicated to listen to that, but at the same time, you say, "Hey, wait a minute! You know, I'm working some pretty long DX here, from 20,000 miles up and 20,000 miles back. And I'm doing this with something in my backyard. And that's the thing that's just absolutely amazing about all this.
Why don't you go ahead? I know that AMSAT, you have a website.
Yes, we do.
And kind of just give us a brief on the website and how folks can get started.
There are some links off of our website. It's www.amsat.org. www.amsat.org. There's some information up there on our new launch of our satellite, which we're looking forward to. But there's also some information and links there on how to get started. We have AMSAT also offers for donation, a suggested donation, some getting started books that can be ordered from our office in Silver Spring, Maryland. And folks are interested in doing that. The other thing was we also have a group of we call our field officers that are essentially satellite Elmers that are there to help people get started, because there are some questions and people, I'm sure, like you said, you know, it's complicated and I can't do it. But on the other hand, if you've got somebody that says, yeah, okay, here's what you need to do this, you need to do that, and so forth. I'm currently writing a column called Getting Started on the Satellites for Monitoring Times with Bob Grove's operation. And we've gone through a whole series of how to get started and what you need to do and so forth. I'm also writing, I've done some writing for our journal, and our journal, which also has that kind of information to it if you become a member of AMSAT. But again, we're nonprofit. We're a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. We've got one full-time paid staff person. The rest of us are all volunteers.
So what does it cost to join AMSAT?
$44 per year is okay. What it is. We also have a student membership rate, which is half of that. So if you're in college, student, and you want to get started.
So as a member, what do you receive?
You get
the encoder pin or the secret decoder pin?
Yeah, right. No, we have we publish a journal, which comes out four times per year, six times per year. It's every other month, and you also have the opportunity to, because your part of your donation goes to supporting us building and launching and buying parts to put satellites in orbit. It's kind of like your local repeater group. You know, if you use the repeater, you kind of feel like you should be supporting it. So that's what we're thinking. The same thing with the AMSAT stuff is that we're supporting the
somebody needs to publish a book called The 1 Minute Conversation, though. The 1 Minute QSO. How to do a 1 Minute QSO.
Well, we do it all the time on these satellites. It's hello, how are you, good morning, and goodbye.
Well, you don't hear that on 75 meters.
No.
I had something happen, and I love people at RagChew. I was having problems with the radio, and I wanted to just check and see if it was working. So I just dialed up a QSO, and there was a bunch of guys talking. I'll just wait. When there's a break, I'll go ahead and slow throw my call in and just ask them if they can hear me. And so I threw my call in. I didn't throw my call in. I didn't have a chance to. This guy was talking, and I clocked him. I clocked this guy talked for 55 solid minutes. You know, and then he took a break. You know, and I,
did you get your call in?
Well, I know I didn't even bother. I was too tired. I figured the next person that came up that was going to acknowledge my call may talk for another 45 minutes, you know. So I just kind of, but I, after a while, it became kind of like, how long is he going to talk? Let me just sit here and see, you know. I was like very, but of course, rag chewing is.
It's another part of the hobby, Ted.
It's become a lost art.
Yeah.
Except this guy. He obviously had a PhD because he could flat get with the program.
Yeah,
he
would just talk to him. That's the beauty of the hobby. And that's what I've said. No matter what your interest is, there's so many pieces to this that if you get tired of doing one thing, you can always go off and do something else and still be within the hobby of amateur radio.
There you go.
That's the beauty of it. So anyway, appreciate all you do, Ted, to get folks interested and to get them motivated to get their amateur radio license. It's it's a fantastic hobby. It's a lifelong hobby. I've been at this since going back almost 35, 40 years now, and it's just a wonderful experience. And the people that I've met along the way, particularly at AMSAT, I mean, where else can you sit down across the table from an astronaut and have them tell you what it's like to ride on the shuttle? And you're having lunch with them. I mean, that's, you know, Joe Ham off the street, because most of the shuttle astronaut, most of the astronauts have amateur radio licenses because they're operating the equipment that's the amateur radio equipment that's on the shuttle, on the International Space Station, which by the way is AMSAT's project. That's one of our projects, is to put that equipment up there.
Once again, your website is
www.amsat.org.
There you go, folks.
Thank you, Ted.
Check out the website.
Absolutely. Appreciate the time.
If you've got the itch to want to get operating satellites, according to what this gentleman says here, it's not difficult.
No.
And you can have a whole lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, and the only dumb question is the one you don't ask.
There you go.
Take care, Ted. Thanks.
Thank you so much for coming by.
You bet. I enjoy it. Take care.
I have another fellow sitting here who's been waiting here. He's been very patient with a pair of headphones on. I'm going to let you introduce yourself. I'm hoping the mic is turned on here. If not, okay.
Hi, Ted. I'm Neil Rapp, WB9VPG, and I teach chemistry, and I'm the Ham Radio Club sponsor at Bloomington High School South in Bloomington, Indiana. And just had one of my students make a presentation at the Youth Forum here this morning at Dayton Hamvention, and was featured on the cover of QST in the May edition.
That's very good.
He, after spending a year in our club, he embarked on his own de-expedition to the island of Cyprus. And so he was presenting about that today and talking about that, and that's also the topic of his QST article. And it's been kind of special because it's kind of come full circle. I brought with me the Hamvention program from 1977, and that was when I came to Dayton the first time, and was sitting in the Kenwood booth down the hall here signing QSL cards and greeting everybody, and was featured with a picture in the program. And at that time, was the world's youngest ham. So kind of come full circle now that that I'm teaching, and now I have a youngster here that is in the program and presenting and in QST magazine. So we're real proud of Padraig Lissandru, KC9UUS, and his accomplishments. And there he is. He's standing right here. So he's done a fine job. He's the president of our club, and maybe we can get Padraig over here for a minute. He's done some amazing things, and he's had an amazing year, and he's getting ready to go to a solar bike race over in Japan, and so he's going to be back on the air again. He's taking his rig on the flight with him over to Japan this summer.
He's having to take the backpack off and all the get up and everything here.
Yeah, and all the gear he got a hold of this morning after the youth forum. They had to give him a backpack to put it all in. He's raking in the prizes this morning.
I'm
going
to let you introduce this young man here and tell us.
This is Padraig Lissandru, KC9UUS, and he's a junior. And right now he's the president of our club, and he's also one of my advanced placement chemistry students in organic chemistry. He has to put up with me two periods a day. So, hey, Padraig?
So, now how long has he been in the hobby?
About 2 years now.
2 years? Get up on that microphone there. It's
real sorry.
Close talking mic and speak up so folks can hear.
Yeah, I think was it like November of 2010 I went tech, and then for the next couple months I just got my general and extra. I got them in all 3 months.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't have a hard time with it, but you know, if it's stuff that you really, really like, then it's easy. So.
Well, now what's your interest in ham radio? I mean, what draws you into what part of it? Where do you spend most of your time?
Well, I mean, I love 20 meter. I like DX. Ham radio is like, it's just got so many different sub hobbies, and I was into shortwave for a while, just listening really. I don't know, just I have a lot of interests.
Well, you know, right now you're on two shortwave radio stations at the same time.
Sweet.
Yeah, you're on WBCQ out of Monticello, Maine, on 93.30, and WTWW just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, Lebanon, Tennessee, on 99.30.
Sweet.
So two of the, I guess I want to say, most powerful signals coming out of the United States. So when you're talking to that microphone, you're modulating these great big gigantic tubes and shooting something akin to flames out an antenna up against the ionosphere, you know. Now, the reason why we put both stations together today, we're trying to compete with HARP, and we're going to see if we can't create a weather change here in Dayton so that we don't get any rain and all we get is, you know, 80 degrees and sunshine. What do you think about that?
You know, I've always wanted to see a black body radiation study of Dayton during Hamvention. I've always wondered what in the world would that look like, because
so many people,
there's just so much RF around here. The cell phones have been pretty much dead the whole weekend so far, at least. So, yeah, that'd be interesting to see if we can change any weather patterns.
Well, tell me, how did you get interested in ham? What grabbed you?
Well, I mean, my mom, you know, told me, oh, you should join this club. It's cool. Because she's over there. Yeah? Hey, Mom. Actually, we listen to you all the time. So, so she got interested. She told me to join the club. I joined. Immediately saw that it was, you know, very technical, and I liked that. As a little kid, I was building stuff all the time, and the first time I got into it, because I didn't understand how RC cars worked, and I would take those apart and destroy them. But I got into it because of the technical aspect, and then that drove me further into electronics, and now I build circuits and design stuff, and yeah. So it was my mom, really.
I had a gentleman sit down next to me last year, and here's what he said. And just excuse me here while I shoot a quick picture of you guys from my cell phone. He said, well, younger people are no longer interested, basically, in HF radio. And HF radio, as we know it, is probably gonna die in a few years. And, of course, the Internet will take over. Now, how old are you?
I just turned 16.
You just turned 16. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, there certainly isn't enough, you know, young kids or kids getting into it. And, I mean, there might be some truth there, but I don't like to think about it. I certainly like HF. I know I'll keep doing it. I will keep popularizing. But if it does die, then so...
You couldn't prove it by what we're experiencing.
Yeah,
we've,
exactly.
In the 10 years that I've sponsored a club there, we've run over 100 kids through, and over 30 of them licensed. They really get into contesting. They really get into transmitter hunting. But this school club roundup contest twice a year that we get on 20 meters mostly, and the kids just really get after it and try to make just as many contacts as they can, and they absolutely love it.
Not to change the subject, but I was just going to say, we got Joe coming up here, and Joe is the chief cook bottle washer when it comes to kits.
Absolutely.
And CQ Magazine. He's coming up, so don't touch that dial. But here's my take on this, and I don't know. When the fella said this, I was like, what? You know? I still think that the first time I ever saw amateur radio operated was a guy in Dearborn, Michigan. Name was Nelson Cosby. I can't remember Nelson's call sign. But he had a pretty good old piece of... I mean, he had a Heathkit Marauder and an SX-101 and a Homebrew Linear and a 4-element 20-meter beam. And he got on and he talked to some guy in Denver, Colorado, and I watched him do it, okay? Now, I know we can talk to Denver, Colorado on a cell phone. We can talk over some... I'm sure there's some sort of chat, voice chat thing you can do on your cell phone. But to think that you're doing this through the air, you know, it blew me away. And as a kid, I'd tune in shortwave stations, and I'd hear things coming in. I don't think any of that's changed. I think the computer has made it far better because now we got QRZ. Yeah. If you talk to somebody, you can look them up and get a picture of their shack and their face and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But I when that guy said that, I just curled up. I thought, I can't believe this, you know, because I remember when television came out, they said this is going to destroy radio. You know, well, it didn't. You know, and yet we still run into some of these curmudgeons that they'll say Echolink. Oh, it's of the devil. It's evil. You know, and I just don't like it because people can talk to each other and not even use a radio. Well, they don't do that often. You know. But it is a little convenient if we're on a repeater. If I'm talking to you on Echolink and the machine you're talking on is really busy, and I want to talk to you about something specific that nobody else would be interested in, but I can call you out to a private, I guess I want to call it room, I don't know, and get on, and the two of us can talk privately about what we got without dragging everybody on the machine into it at that time, you know.
And we've used Echolink just a little bit, and one of the things that we did this year that was really neat for us. One of our students,
RX.
had moved to actually down by Lebanon, Tennessee, mm-hmm. So he wasn't able to, you know, to finish his senior year at Bloomington South. And so one week during the school club roundup, we got on Echolink and was able to have the kids talk to him, you know, through Echolink while they're operating on the school club roundup on HF. So we've done a few things with Echolink, and you know, there's a time and a place for it, just like like all of our other technologies.
But yeah, that kid that that used to be in our club that's doing Echolink, his name is Runzhang.
Runzhang, yeah.
Well, we call him RX, which is kind of appropriate. It's kind of funny, but yeah, that's his nickname. He goes by RX, so.
Ladies and gentlemen, this broadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2013 is brought to you by HamTest Online. And we'll be back with more of Hamvention 2013 right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there.
and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to a rebroadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2013, brought to you by Hamtest Online. And now, back to the Hamvention.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you something. I think that I think if amateur radio is presented, and I think that's all you got to do is just present it. I think when people see what it is, there's a certain percentage of the population that's going to go, wow, I want to get into this. And there's another percentage of the population that's going to say, oh, that's cool, and they go on their way. You know? I mean, it's just what you're drawn to. You know, and some folks are drawn to it, some folks are not.
And that's really one of our goals of our program is, you know, I teach chemistry. And so people are like, well, how in the world does ham radio relate to chemistry? Well, we talk about electromagnetic spectrum with, you know, similarities with electrons. And so I use it in the classroom. I demonstrate what's going on. We start talking about being able to listen to drive-up windows at McDonald's and my garage door opener suddenly firing, you know, when I'm transmitting and things like that. And that attracts kids. And you know, every time I have another group of kids come through and graduate, I think, okay, where's the next group going to come from? And they keep coming because I make that one-day presentation in class. And some of them are going, yeah, I really want to do that. And so they join our club. We have an after-school program at our school, and they keep coming back. So, you know, we've had several come through. Patrick is our latest and greatest so far. But, you know, we've had a lot of kids come through. And even the kids that aren't licensed, they at least know now what ham radio is and what it's used for and have a lot better respect for it.
And the importance.
And a lot of them have gone on to get their license.
I really admire what you guys are doing. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to give a website out or something where folks can contact you that want to try to follow in your footsteps. Because I think it's important. I think it's cool. I once had one little gal sat down here that had just completed Ham Test Online mm-hmm. and had got her ticket. And I said, what do we got to do to get more young people into ham radio? I said, what things have we got to change? And she popped right back and she said, we don't got to change anything. She said, all you got to do is just show it to them.
Yeah.
And then she went on like kind of like, I'm kind of tired of hearing about how we've got to change this and change that. She says, it's cool the way it is. You know, just have to share it and change it. I will want to add one thing, and that is this. In ham radio, we do have our share, and I refer to them as curmudgeons, okay? And the curmudgeons, I mean, we've had them in our fair city of Nashville, Tennessee, where they will run young people off a repeater. They hear a young voice on there. What's he doing on there? Oh, yeah, it goes back to the CQ, no kids, no lids, no space cadets.
Yeah,
yeah. That's that type of mentality.
No lids, no kids, extra class only was the one I always heard when I was a kid.
So I think that I think we're doing well. And when you run into a curmudgeon, ignore him. You know, chances are he ain't going to be around a whole lot longer, you know. Suffering from hardening of the attitudes, you know. And I see a lot of that. And it's really and truly a good thing for someone like you to be able to kind of combat that. And somebody like yourself here, you know, when you hear one of those guys, either do one of two things. Ignore them or harass them a little bit, okay? Just remember, they've got nothing going on in their life, okay? And when you harass them a little bit, you get their blood flow going, they're getting more oxygen to the brain, you know, and they probably will think a little bit more logically, you know? And then ignore it. In other words, don't take it to heart.
Just
say,
ignore it.
Say, what a nut, you know, and go on your way.
because we have them out there, and it's they're not a majority, but they're like a squeaky wheel. You know, you can have 100 wheels on some sort of a contraption that works just fine. One squeaky one makes you feel as if, you know, the whole thing's ready to come apart, you know. And
when we get on School Club Roundup, everybody's just fabulous. They really want to encourage the kids, and they'd like to get on there and talk for a while. The kids are like, okay, got to move on. We got to get some points here. But everybody's really great about it. And every once in a while, like you said, every once in a great while, we'll get somebody who either tries to take the frequency over or might, you know, say, you know, try to correct the kids into something that's not really, you know, they really don't need to be corrected, but they think they need to be corrected. And you know, I say two words, move on. You know, yeah. Move on. We really haven't had any problems with it. And like I said, especially School Club Roundup weeks, we've just had a fabulous response to people that will make contacts with us, and it's gone really, really well.
Well, I want to thank you guys for coming by. I think this is a cool thing that you're doing, and I admire you very much for what you're doing. And all I can say is just keep moving forward and making it fun and making it happen. I've said a number of times, I believe this, I think sometimes we make amateur radio too serious, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. So have fun, you know, and just kind of squash the curmudgeons as you go down the road and seize it and take it over, because it's just as much yours as it is anyone else's that's on the frequencies. You've studied, you've passed the test, you're in there. And don't let anybody hold you back or impede your fun and what you're doing. You know,
that's just, thanks a lot. If people are interested, we are an ARRL Education and Technology Program school. They provide grants for us and all kinds of resources. So if you look on the ARRL webpage, there is an education section there. You can get more information about it there. And our URL is so long, I don't even want to try it. So look us up on QRZ. Our call sign is K9SOU, Kilo 9 Sierra Oscar Uniform. Just look us up on QRZ. There's a link there that you can get to us and see what we're doing at Bloomington High School South.
All righty. Well, I thank you much for coming by. I appreciate it. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks.
This is live from Dayton. This is the Hamvention 2013. And we're here at Hera Arena, and we're surrounded by people, all kinds of people going in every which way direction, and all kinds of things going on. But we do have Joe. Joe just sat down here 2 hours ago, and he seriously, he's been sitting here for a long time. Now, if you run into Joe, you can spot him here at Dayton, because he has this big, gigantic Cat in the hat on. And it's kind of a red and white stripe thing as he walks through. And I know that one of the very first times I came to Dayton and I saw this guy, and I thought, what in the world is that all about? You know, why would a guy wear a hat like that here? I mean, I figured it had something to do with something, but I didn't know what the something was. So I'm going to let you, first off, explain what the something was.
Well, one year I was sick and I missed Hamvention. And so the following year, I wore a ball cap like most guys do with my name and call on it. But a lot of my friends said they missed me when they talked to me over the air. They say, well, we missed you 2 years in a row. And I said, well, I had my hat on last year. I was here. And they said, well, maybe you need a bigger hat. So I thought, okay, maybe they're right. And so I decided that I would put on a bigger hat so that my friends could spot me, because I used to spend over half my time trying to find the friends that I only get to see once a year. Now they come to me. They all know where I am. And so after the first year, I took it off, but I did bring it with me. And the second year, they asked, where's the hat? And I said, it's out in the car. And they said, well, we can't find you without the hat. So it became quite a tradition that's kept on now for about 19 years.
Well, I wanted to make sure to bring you on and to talk to you, because you put a lot of work in every year. I see you also at the Huntsville Ham Fest,
mm-hmm.
but without the hat.
Nope, nope. It's a Dayton thing.
Yeah, see, I think you ought to make it both of them because you're easier to find with a hat. I mean, we can find you with that hat. Now, once we find you, I don't know what we're going to do with you, but we can't even find you. But you put a lot of work and effort into, well, actually, tell folks what you do. Once again, we're talking to Joe Eisenberg. Call sign is K0NEB. And tell us a little bit about what you do in the amateur radio realm.
Well, what I do is I write the monthly kit building column in CQ Magazine. You can go to www.cq-amateur-radio.com, and you can take a look at it. CQ Magazine is one of the oldest publications in amateur radio. We have several thousand subscribers both in this country and around the world. A lot of people look at CQ Magazine and say, well, it's primarily contest and DX-oriented, which isn't the case. Over half the articles in it have nothing to do with that. And even though I once in a while participate in the CQ on the air contest myself, that really wasn't why I was brought on. The reason I was brought on was because we saw the need to talk about building kits. And the reason is when you look at the history of amateur radio all the way up until the 90s, kit building was the main way that most people could afford amateur radio. I mean, there was brand name equipment and so forth all the way from the 1930s. But it was not affordable to the average ham, especially in the Depression. And so you had breadboard kits and things like that that were put together by different companies. And then, of course, after World War II, you had this huge glut of surplus parts. Well, one company decided, hey, we can make an oscilloscope kit out of all the surplus parts from old radar installation components. And they made an oscilloscope. That company was Heathkit. And then they got more into the amateur radio world and became very dominant in amateur radio. I would say in the 1960s and early 70s, more hams ran Heathkit gear than anything else. And they built them themselves and they could fix them and modify them themselves. Now back in the 90s, in this very room where we're sitting right now, Heathkit had a booth and they sold out everything below cost. And they were gone. Absolutely gone. And everybody thought that kit building was dead. And for a year or two, I mourned the loss because I would come here and there might be one or two little kits, like a digital clock or something, but nothing for ham radio. And then kits started reappearing. You had Ramsey kits and Electronic Rainbow kits. And pretty soon you have companies like Elecraft. And now we have Hendrix kits. And we have a whole host of kits that are available right now that let you get back into the spirit of building and modifying and doing the things that we as hams have done for decades. So I used to call my talk, when I would try to get people to build and teach them ways to do it, the lost art of kit building. Well, it's not a lost art anymore. There are a lot of people doing it, but what we try to do is teach them ways to do it so they have a better chance of success. Because if you build it and it doesn't work, chances are you're not going to ever try building again. But if you know the techniques and learn enough and you have somebody else that looks at your board before you power it up, you now have something that you built yourself and you're making contacts with on the air. And it gives you a sense of pride, accomplishment, and you learn how the thing works. And so that's fundamental to amateur radio as far as I'm concerned. And what I'm hoping is that more and more people will get into kit building and there'll be more and more companies making kits.
Well, you know, I was going to say, it wasn't just Heathkit. See, I was born and raised in Michigan, so I used to go to Benton Harbor, mm-hmm. where their headquarters were.
Well, you had Globe and Knight and several others.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Knight kits, the Ico kits, I remember building an Ico 753 tri-bander, mm-hmm. and it drifted and drifted.
It was called the 753.
Yeah, yeah. I thought they could have repaired that thing by putting a clock drive on the PTO, just like you do on a telescope, you know, that tracks the star. You put...
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And sorry to say, that's all the time we've got for this week's broadcast. We'll be back next week, same time, same station, right here on WTWW. Be sure to listen tonight
at 7 p.m. Central on 5085 for a rebroadcast of the Dayton Hamvention 2013. Thank you for listening in 73.